Welcome to SFDC Consultant Podcast, the podcast where we try to discover what it takes to be a brilliant Salesforce consultant. My name is Emmerich, and I have been working in the Salesforce ecosystem for over 7 years. I have worked and implemented numerous projects in both public and private sector. Together with my co-host Viorel, we will aim to explore the tools, tips, and best practices with a range of Salesforce practitioners.
My name is Viorel, and one of the reasons we've started this podcast is to shine a light, really, on the road to become successful Salesforce consultants. In our future episodes, we will have the pleasure to discuss with our guests, experienced professionals from the consultancy world, what exactly means to be successful, along with everything else required to get there. While Emmerich is already beginning to be versed in the arts of fine consulting, I have recently joined the Salesforce world in November 2019. And therefore my perspective will be completely different, one of a beginner's. And I hope that this will allow for the questions that I ask our guests resonate with some of you, which have yet to start on this path, or are thinking of pursuing it. And where better to start than right at the beginning of the career of a Salesforce consultant, the recruitment company. Today we'll be speaking with Teresa Durant, and for those of you that are not familiar with her name, you might be more familiar with the name of her company she founded, Resource On Demand. That is the Europe's first Salesforce recruitment company. Yes, she has been there from the start.
We've actually been a user of Salesforce since 2007, so we're probably one of the very first customers in the UK to start using Salesforce, and was actually at the CloudForce event, the very first one in the UK when Mark Benioff actually turned up. There was only probably about 250 attendees in a hotel in London. But we've had our business working on Salesforce. We've been recruiting Salesforce since about 2008, 2009. We've worked with global massive end users to global consulting companies, tiny little non-profits and sort of everything in between, really. So yes, we do have a very holistic overview of the market and how Salesforce consultants fit into that. Back in the early days, we used to actually work with Salesforce directly to get people onto their training programs when it was the ADM 201 courses and things like that. We've actively tried to produce material, training material for consultants. And I'm sure if you go on Google, there's probably some very embarrassing videos out there from the early days when we probably didn't quite know as much as we do now. But, you know, it's always one of our angles is to try and promote skills, because from day one, there has been, and probably to a certain extent still is, quite a massive skills gap. So we've always worked actively to try and help people and point them into the right direction of getting training and stuff like that. So yes, it's been a big part of what we do. Hopefully I've got some good information to share with you.
I wanted to ask first, since you've been there from the beginning, especially in the UK, there's always been known that the Salesforce market is always growing. So have you felt this growth as well as in your business?
Oh, absolutely. We started off the business and I, you know, confess it was a bit of a lifestyle business at the time. We had these big plans to travel around and do what we do on the road. We almost became a victim of our success because we were the first Salesforce recruitment only, certainly in the UK and across Europe. And it became very apparent that the market was surging at the time. It was just massively taking off. I mean, as we know, Salesforce is a major marketing machine. So it kind of rapidly started to grow, and we then ended up having to take people on. What became a lifestyle business actually became us working from an office with, you know, a team of people around us and looking to recruit all the time and hire people within our business. So we felt the impact of that. And I think it probably part of our success came down to the fact that we were also customers of Salesforce. So we really understood the ecosystem. We understood how the ecosystem worked, how partners, programs worked, how the customer success side of it with the sales teams within Salesforce itself worked. And I think that kind of gave us a really good footing, because when we were talking to people about Salesforce, and let's face it, Salesforce is full of very passionate people. I don't think I've ever worked in a technology space before where people absolutely are passionate about the technology they work on. That came across, and I think from our point of view, we didn't really have to go and look for business. It just came to us because we were part of that ecosystem and understood it. But one of the things I always direct people towards, so we deal with a lot of people just coming into Salesforce, and they'll come to us and they'll say, you know, I've been sort of dabbling around for 6 months. I'm struggling to get my career off the ground. And one of the things I would say to them is you have to get online and become part of the community. Your opportunity to learn and grow from other people's experiences will only help and enhance what you do. So I think from that point of view, there is a low barrier to entry when it comes to coming into Salesforce. And anybody from any walk of life can just start learning and start becoming part of that community and, you know, networking and so on.
In terms of the market and what I mean by that, the size of the resource of staff members, that's probably, you know, because there's always kind of this thing about shortage of skills within that. And, yeah. You know, there are organizations out there putting these like surveys out about compensations that people are getting and X amount of percentage wise, you know, developers and consultants and admins that will be required in the next 3 to 5 years. Is that something that you're also kind of subscribing to in terms of a view to see that, well, there is this shortage of skill, yes, mm-hmm. but how substantial and how big will that actually be? And you know, is there an impact that may have onto the existing kind of you know, users and specialists in the area?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we know that there is a skills gap because from our point of view, we don't necessarily have to work at picking up jobs as such. So, I mean, if you look at sort of developers, it's on average, there's probably 4 jobs to every 1 developer. And if you look at the permanent job market where clients actually want to take developers on full-time permanent basis, there aren't enough developers that are willing to go permanent because most of them are sort of, I suppose, attracted to the contract market because of the rates. But if you then start looking at sort of technical architects or very technical positions, you're then looking at sort of difference between 10 jobs for every 1 TA that there is out there. So there is a massive gap in the market. And with the sort of anticipated number of jobs expecting to sort of flood the market over the next couple of years, you'd only really see that gap widen because it takes quite a long time for a TA to actually get to that level. I mean, I know there are some people that have done it fairly quickly, but, you know, by and large, you are looking at a good few years for somebody to sort of maybe move up towards being a technical architect. However, I would say that there's been quite a big shift in market, and it appreciate it's only temporary, but we have seen quite a big shift because of the coronavirus. And I appreciate that there have been a load of companies have just decided to shut up shop for a couple of weeks, born out of fear or panic or just how they're going to get their business through this. But we might actually kind of see a bit of a shift in market because I think with the potential to do a bit of homeworking, people might start to look further afield for their talents, or they might utilise them in different areas. So I would like to, you know, be very interested to see how the next sort of 6 months to perhaps 12 months will pan out in respect to skill shortages. So, for example, you know, we've got a couple of clients in certain locations in the UK. They're kind of in like a Bermuda Triangle of skills. So they're shopping around for people with certain skill sets, usually technical, and they're struggling to find them. But the fact that people are now getting used to working from home means that people might actually broaden their nets and will actually look further afield for those talents, and therefore actually might be able to fill the gaps that, you know, fill the jobs that they've been struggling with. So I think it's going to be a really interesting time over the next few months just to see how much this remote working will impact the Salesforce ecosystem moving forward. Salesforce itself is probably, it's one of the most robust industries out there. In fact, we started up our business in 2008 when the recession hit. So Salesforce was already come through one. It was robust because of the fact it was cloud technology. But it's amazing how many people working within a cloud technology industry still want their people with bums on seats in their offices, which kind of is a bit ironic, really. And so I'd like to see what influence this is going to have on the whole ecosystem over the next 6 to 12 months, because I think it's going to be pretty interesting. And if you even think about mums, for example, and I don't want to pick on mums specifically because there are stay-at-home dads as well, but we have women that are trying to get back into technology, having taken time off for childcare, and they haven't been able to do it because their company hasn't been able to offer a remote way of working. Well, actually, that problem might be resolved. So there could be more people coming into the technology space because they see that opportunity. And I think that will only be a good thing.
Absolutely. And I think this reminds me of the Salesforce movement about the work from home moms campaign they had years ago, where there were a lot of moms that were struggling to get back in the market. And because of Salesforce, they're able to learn new skills and get into jobs working from home successfully as well.
Absolutely. And it doesn't matter what time they work, you know, if they're putting their little ones down to bed and they work in the evening. As long as the job gets done, the job gets done. And I think as long as the end result that you have a very happy client, it shouldn't really matter. So, you know, I'm really interested to see how these next few months are going to look like, because, yes, things will go back to normal, but it will be a different kind of normal. And I think that's going to be quite an exciting prospect.
Absolutely. And one other perspective on this is, if you think about it, the management of companies will have to change as well. Because working from home, you'll have to start measuring your employees on the output instead of input.
Absolutely.
So it's such an old school way of going to the office as a manager, checking the pulse of the business, looking around. You don't really know what people are doing. You just know that they're there. And it's such a long delay until you realize somebody's not productive. Well, when you're working from home, the output is measured in so much faster fashion that you'll know exactly if someone's productive or not.
Possibly for the larger consultancies, it's going to be much harder for them to change, whilst the smaller consulting companies are going to be more agile and certainly more nimble. So they'll probably embrace that change a lot quicker and be able to kind of sustain that moving forward. I think when it comes to how can a candidate set themselves apart, and that's a really interesting question, and we get asked that all the time, and you know, there is no short answer as such, but I will try and keep it short. And I think the main thing is people have to be very honest about the projects that they work on. And I think also it's important, if people are applying, and I'm only going to talk about the UK market in this instance, because every market has its own nuances. But if we are looking at the UK market, for example, when applicants are applying from abroad, they talk about the projects that they've worked on as part of a team. They very rarely reference what they've actually done within a project themselves. And I think in the UK, we want to know, what were you responsible for? What did you do? What were the outcomes? And we kind of mean it specifically to that person. So when you look at applications coming from certain countries, they always talk about the project team they work in, and it's really hard to pick out what their personal strengths are. So I think people need to be honest about what they've done within projects and not talk about themselves as a project team, but talk about themselves personally. And I think if you think about CVs, they're like a sales pitch. They're your elevator pitch to a potential client. It's really important to have evidence of the projects that you've worked on. And that becomes your evidence when you go into an interview situation to say, hey, this is the project, this is the scope of the project, this is the size of it, this is what I did, this is what the outcome was, and this is how it improved the end client's turnover or efficiency or whatever, you know, your task to do, and have that supporting evidence.
So it's specifics then?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah. I was going to say to that is you know, because a few things that you've kind of listed there is, first things first, to, you know, kind of concentrate on your own kind of areas of responsibility, and actions that you've taken and outcomes that were based from what you've personally did. Basically I was going to follow up with the question of, like, you know, what would be the qualities of that consultancies are looking for? Presumably when they're coming up to you, they would already have some type of job spec together, wouldn't it? But do you see some type of things that they're constantly asking for? And I'm not specifically thinking about technical skills,
because I maybe soft skills.
Yeah, because I do know that there is this, because technical stuff you can learn, That's the power. That's the power of the platform and what it offers, the technology. But the soft skills, I think somehow, you know, consultancies are expecting them to be there and to be further increased or improved, but to have a starting point. What would you say that kind of starts, you know, that should be a baseline that consultancies are looking for?
Yeah. I mean, in some respects, I tend to pay little attention to a job spec because usually it's wish list, and it will talk about we want people to be good communicators, and you know, they've got to be able to problem solve and things like that. But I think ultimately, if you think about the traits that make a very good consultant, well, they have to be really good at listening. And I know that sounds like a very simple thing to sort of mention. But when you are a consultant, it's really important that you understand what are the pain points of your customers. Now, if you're out there trying to sell a solution at them, the minute you walk through the door, you're never going to understand what it is, what problems that they're trying to resolve. So for me, it's always you've got to have fantastic listening skills. You've got to be good at negotiating as well, because you know a customer will have this idea about what is achievable in their business, but actually it might not be possible for them, or they might be looking at somebody else who said, well, I've got X, Y, and Z in my business, and they're thinking, why can't I have that? And you have to be able to, you know, negotiate with them or have good conflict resolution skills to be able to talk to people about is what is possible within their own organization. And it's kind of like a bartering act. It's like, you know, if you've got to roll a project out in stages, you've got to be able to communicate that to them and negotiate around what are the parameters that that organisation should be working within. They've also, a good consultant's got to be someone that can push back a little bit as well, because, you know, who's the expert in the room? If you can't put your point across succinctly and you can't push back when a client is just, trying to overstep the mark or trying to get you to do things that aren't within the, you know, the remit of the project, you've got to be able to push back politely and say, you know, that forms part of a different project as well. So it's kind of having that gravitas to be able to walk into a room and own that project and be able to steer the stakeholders within the right directions. And also to see opportunity as well, because, you know, whilst it's not all about selling as such, ultimately, your business wants to sell their product. So you have to seek opportunities to be able to cross-sell or upsell, or even just present opportunities of things that are possible that the client might not have even seen before. So you've got to be able to have a big picture thinking. And I think really good consultants will be able to sort of helicopter themselves up, you know, and be able to look at the business as a whole and be able to say, well, how can we make more things efficient, how can we improve processes, and think of things that the business ordinarily wouldn't have been able to see. And so I think big picture thinkers are pretty good when it comes to that holistic overview. And you've also got to really be following best practices as well. You know, there are great guidelines that Salesforce set themselves around how to deliver projects, and absolutely following best practice. I mean, a few years back, there was this sort of common theme where everything was overdeveloped, and it was almost like if you wanted to change a field or change the way a record looked up to a different record within Salesforce, or you know, even just freeing up a license for somebody else to have that license, it was almost like you had to go through a developer or some technical team to be able to make that change. And I think Salesforce, quite a number of years back now, made that shift towards trying to move away from like systems being locked down, because that almost went against what Salesforce was built for, which was that it doesn't matter how big your organization was, you could have that same functionality as a one-man band as what a massive global organization was. And the only difference that prevented that was when, unfortunately, some consulting companies come in and they created a system that was locked out for its end user. And they had to go back to them every time they wanted a small tweak or change. And I think best practice is there to kind of prevent that and create that sort of level playing field again. So people that can follow that and understand what's in the client's best interest versus what is in the consultant's best interest. So, yeah, they're probably some of the soft skills and really understanding the capabilities as well of what Salesforce can and can't do.
Yeah, I was going to say to that, because I've done a kind of a few. I've worked in like other technologies in the past, but with Salesforce, I feel that it's okay to say that because it does so much that, like you said earlier, it's impossible to say that I am a fully fledged all products and segments on all clouds expert. Yes. It's literally impossible to do that. I was at this event in London at the Tower a few months ago, and we had this senior product manager, and he was doing some work on Einstein, on the Einstein Analytics platform. And I asked him a question which was related to, you know, some core platform, you know, kind of functionality. And he said, "I know what you mean, but I think that, you know, we'll need to find you someone else to ask this question because they'll probably be in a better position to give you the fully fledged like implications of that rather than me. I can tell you from the Einstein part, but, you know, there's someone better to answer this question from the other side." So even the Salesforce, you know, experts or, you know, the people that are actually working on this from within the company, they will be open about this, the fact that there's no one person that knows everything.
Absolutely. And I think another thing as well, it's just as you were saying that made me think about it, was sometimes industry knowledge. So if there is a particular industry sector that you work in, that can more than make up for what you lack in the technology skills, because there is always an expert that you can ask. And I don't, you know, any reasonable customer wouldn't expect you to know the answer to everything. And quite frankly, if I'm an end client, do I really want to know how you're going to build it or what the technical terminology is or whether you're going to make a workflow that fires off an email? Do I really need to know that? All I really want to know is it going to fix my problem? Is it going to make us more money? Is it going to make us more efficient? So being able to go, do you know what, I'm going to go and ask somebody rather than winging it. That's fine, absolutely fine. But I would say that having some niche of industry, so, you know, if you work in the financial sector, for example, you'll understand what the restrictions are, what the legislation is, and you can make sure that you're putting that into every solution that you're designing as a consultant. So I do often say to people, if you've got an area that you're falling into, so if it is retail, if it is travel sector, or if it's financial services or pharmaceuticals, once you've started to understand that, it'll be much easier for you to pitch yourself as an expert because you understand the industry sector that you're working in. And quite often you'll see some clients come to us and say, "I'm not really bothered about the Salesforce skills because we can resolve that at this end. What we really want are people that actually have industry sector, because that's really hard to teach somebody the ins and outs of an industry." So that's something I'd also put highly up on the list. If somebody comes from an education background, well, it would make sense to be looking for the companies potentially that they could go and work with within the education sector. So I would also put that highly up on the list of skills when it comes to consultants about where they want to pitch themselves moving forward.
That goes back to that call for this thing when you're sitting as a consultant across the table with some stakeholders and they have to pitch to you their whole business and their whole industry, and only then you're getting it. That's not going to give them that much confidence. But if you already know the business in and out and you probably had some experience, they'll have that confidence and that trust in you that you really understand what makes them efficient, what makes them money, what makes them go next level.
Yeah, absolutely. And you'll understand what their competitors are doing. You'll understand, the legislation that's, you know, underpins it, particularly in some industry sectors where they're very heavily legislated and they've got regulations that they have to follow. If you understand that, you're kind of talking to them at their level and you understand not just the problems they need to overcome in their business, but the problems they need to overcome in their across their whole industry sector. I think that's quite a powerful thing to have. And I would say there are lots of companies out there that probably would forgive the lack of technological experience for the fact that they have industry experience.
Absolutely.
I think one of the things I probably would say is, because I know obviously this is really about the consultancy work, and I think it's, people ask us this all the time, is it, what the kinds of skills that people look for in larger and smaller consultancies. And I think when it comes to larger consultancies, so we talk about those global sort of IT consulting companies, usually people are sort of, they're kind of pigeonholed within within their roles. So for example, if you've got a BA or you've got a TA, they kind of work within a particular remit. Whereas if you go to sort of smaller boutique kind of consultancy companies, they're looking for a good all-rounder. So they're looking for people with techie skills and soft skills. So I think when you've got consultants out there kind of considering what their career path might look like moving forward, it will be good for them to also have an understanding of, do they want to niche? So do they want to have a particular specialism? So I want to be like the best BA, or I want to be the best pre-sales person. And understand that, because they might be a bit more suited to working in a much bigger consulting company. Or do they like the person who likes a cut and thrust of working in different roles? They like, they like to have a sort of varied workload, work multiple projects and things like that. Because if so, then they might be a bit more suited towards working in a consultant, like a much more smaller consulting company. So I think it's also, like you pointed out, you can have a sort of a niche within a niche within a niche. So you could be a consultant, but you might have industry sector, and then you might have the type of consulting companies you want to work for. And we often get people coming to us and they don't understand what it is about a large consultancy. They don't understand how they work. And on the flip side, you get people coming from a large consulting company who then struggle in a much smaller consulting company, because of the fact they have to almost wear different sort of hats and carry out different functions. So I think when people are thinking about their whole career path, it's kind of, where do they see themselves? What do they want to be doing on a daily basis? Because I think that can also help people to determine the right companies that will work for them. And I do think that there are so many people out there that don't really give that sort of some consideration when they start their career path. And these are things that, yes, you can change it as you go along the way, but I think it does help to have some kind of a career plan. And so many people give that little thought that they actually find themselves bouncing from job to job, which could be another reason why you see people moving quite frequently, is because they haven't thought about what their career path looks like for them. And it's like anything in life, you have to plan for it. So my only advice would be, people, particularly when they're starting out in their career, is just set some time aside, just think about where they want to be in the next few years, where they want to be in the next 5 years, maybe where they want to be in 10 years, and try to think of a logical path that will get them from where they are now to where they want to be then.
Do you have, or have you encountered some type of, not really trend, but what industries do you see kind of people transitioning for? And you kind of mentioned the fact that, well, it kind of doesn't really matter as long as potentially that particular industry is what you concentrate on with Salesforce, then that already gives you a big kind of advantage. Having a financial sector background, if you do financial sector or you work within a project like that, you're already halfway through there. But the one thing that, again, within the Salesforce ecosystem, you'll find a few people here and there which have a very unique point about is Salesforce certifications. And I was going to say, because, you have members and consultancies that they pride themselves. We have 125 company-wide certifications, and then you have people that will have 25X Salesforce certifications on their LinkedIn profile and all of that. And I'm thinking, like, wow, I didn't even know there were 25. But then you also have on the other side where people say that the whole certification has been, in a way, taken too far. It's kind of everything in life, something brilliant is given, and then usually people take it too far, where you have people just taking 5-10 certifications, and somehow they use that as a degree, as an expert, basically. The fact that you have two or three certifications all put together, and from the Salesforce pyramid, you get to be an application architect. That doesn't really mean that, you know, you may have the expertise to put together an application for a particular organization. So I was going to say, how do you look at, or what is kind of your take on the Salesforce certifications? You know, how are the consultancies, how are like your clients basically looking at this? You know, do they make a priority of it, or is it something that, well, you might as well just have a few in case you're looking for staff?
What's your opinion about that? Do you know what, this argument has been going since 2009 and it never fails, because depending on who you ask, everybody has a completely different take on it. First of all, I think you need to understand, if I was out on the job market and I'm looking, I'd have to understand the kind of clients that I would be potentially approaching for a job. So, for example, there are some companies out there that are looking to grow, therefore they need to take investment, and it might be that they need to have a certain number of certified people. I mean, we know that the partners, they're required to have certified consultants on their books. So if you're going to go and work for one of those, then yes, absolutely, certifications need to be, you know, sort of a top priority on your CV. However, I always say that you have to have the, you know, you need to be able to put your money where your mouth is. There's no point being one of these people that goes out and gets loads of certifications on their CV, but when it comes to actually being able to do those projects, they're lacking expertise and skill. I do know a couple of candidates out there that it's almost like they take great delight in adding another certification to their belt, but actually they're not as well experienced as, you know, their counterpart who's probably got half the number of certifications as them. For me, certifications should almost be like an underlining of your skills. So don't go and get certifications before you've ever worked on a project that has utilised those particular skills. It's almost like you go and do the project, you get the certification just to say, well, look, I've done the project, I've now got the cert in it. That shows my level of competence and skills. I think for me, experience is always going to be much better than a certification. And the only reason I say this is that because you have people that are what you would call serial learners. So, and it's almost like this sort of imposter syndrome. It's the only way they can convince themselves they're good at what they do is to go out and get these certifications. They don't have the level of expertise that underpins what that certification should represent. So for me, it's you have to have the experience. And I think most companies out there would agree that experience, actually having hands-on experience of working on those projects, is going to be head and shoulders above. I applaud companies that will want to go and encourage their employees to get the certs. And I would almost question somebody who doesn't have any certs as to why they didn't have any, particularly if they've been in the industry for, you know, working on Salesforce for a number of years. It should be as a natural progression that once you've started to get the skills, you should then want to go and get the cert. So I would be curious to why that person didn't have any certs. So, and I think most employers would look at that in the same way. So long story short, you've got to have the experience. The cert should underpin that experience that you have. It shouldn't be in place of the experience. But equally, to be taken seriously in this industry, you have to be getting a few certifications.
I was going to say, where do you stand and how do you see, and I want to cover two things here. One would be compensation, so salaries, and, you know, are those, you know, compared to different industries, again, I'm coming from kind of my point of view. I think we're probably on the high end. So I think anyone that works within Salesforce, they will have, you know, if you are like a Microsoft admin or you know, again, I don't want to like put labels on things because I'm not in the know. But I think from my experience of you know, acquaintances and all of that, I think if you're working within Salesforce, you're probably on the high end of some type of pay scale compared to other areas. So I would want to kind of take your view on that, and even specifically to consultants. Can you because you have different types. You have people that are doing like pre-sales consultancies, like, you know, doing the proof of concept. You have technical, functional, etc. So you have a breadth of types of consultants, and then you have, for example, consultants that would do for like extremely big multinationals, so you're like within a company, and you have consultants for consultancies. So there's like a breadth of, of people that we're talking about. But what I wanted to understand is, where do you stand on the salaries? Are these at this point at the tipping point? Are these going to stagnate? Because I'll be honest, about three, four years ago, I was having a look, and there were salaries about, like, you know, they were hitting the 60K per year here in the UK. And I was thinking, oh my God, you know, such good packages. And then if you were to look, probably right now may not be kind of the good time, but if you were to look in November or October last year, from my point of view, the same that you know, people were hiring for 60K 2 years ago, they were hiring for 80K last year. So I think these have gone up based on shortage of skills and all of that. But what I was going to say, where do you stand on that? And secondly, again, it has become a bit of a trying to attract staff type of tool. But the perks is, like, you know, sometimes, and I'll be honest to say, whenever someone says friendly company, I'm thinking, okay, well, that's brilliant, because I was actually looking to work in a company where people are not friendly. Thank God that you said it's a friendly company. so that's what I'm saying. The perks, because, you know, people are kind of putting, or up to this point, they were putting remote, you know, 2 days remote. And that was, again, that conversation may actually change at this point. But, how do you stand on those two things?
I have seen, I don't know, I'm trying to be diplomatic here, because there are a few companies that we dealt with very early on, and there are companies that still play the game of deliberately offering their roles up for much higher than what the market rate would be. And that was just to secure talent. So I can understand why they would do that in a skills, in a market where there is, you know, lack of skills. They want to make sure that they're getting the best people on the market. But unfortunately, what that has done is driven the, you know, the going rate for a consultant up quite, you know, exponentially. And you're right, when you look at a similar role in a different industry sector or a different technology sector, you know, it's clear to see that the Salesforce salaries are sort of, you know, by far, probably, I'd say around about 15 to 20% more than another technology sector. And that's largely because there are companies out there who are quite open about it, that they would drive up the price on and deliberately over offer in order to skew people. Now, that's great short term for an individual, but unfortunately it doesn't do their career much favours, because unfortunately they then kind of get tied into a company, because, as you know, if you earn more money, your cost of living goes up. You know, those little extras that you buy yourself at the weekend, that money gets basically spent on things to make our lives a little bit nicer. The problem being, if you then want to try and go for a fresh challenge, or you want the opportunity to grow and develop new skills, you're not going to go and get that same offer of salary at a different company. So you end up being stuck in a company much longer than you probably would have, and not being able to develop the skills or get to work on different projects or challenging projects, or even just change industry sectors if you fancy doing that. So what we have seen is quite unhappy people that are working at consulting companies much longer than they really, really intended to do, because they just cannot get that level of salary elsewhere. And I kind of, you know, I feel a bit sorry for them. And the only way they're going to get that experience is to actually take a pay cut. And I think more recently I have seen a few more consultants that have come to us and said, yeah, they're willing to take that pay cut because, you know, the time is right for them to move on. And people have all different reasons for wanting to move on. So we have seen people that have kind of desperately saying, well, I'm going to have to take the pay cut in order to go and get that experience elsewhere. I would hope that would level out at some stage, but unfortunately I've been in the industry sector for 11 years, or in Salesforce for 11 years, and so far I haven't seen any sign of that changing. And so unless something quite significant happens, I can't imagine at this stage that companies will suddenly start saying, do you know what, no, we need to level out the playing field and actually have a bit more of sort of like a salary range across the whole Salesforce ecosystem. I think that that would be a good thing, because it's a shame when you hear of candidates that are being underpaid in some roles for what they're worth, and yet these massive salaries are being offered elsewhere for people that probably aren't quite as deserving as they should be. When it comes to perks, you know, I'm quite actually interested to see how the coronavirus is going to affect that, because up until now, I think the number one thing that people wanted was home working or remote working. It will be replaced by something else, but I'm quite keen to see what that would be. I think most people would either have said home working was the number one thing for them, or probably just a time off or money towards training and getting their certifications. And there are a couple of companies out there, a much smaller consulting company that does this incredibly well, that they have, a very structured plan around incentives and pay rewards based on the back of the certifications that they get. And that's been quite a big draw for them, that, there are people out there that really are biting at the bit, chomping at the bit rather to go and work for them, because they pay for time off for the training, they pay incremental pay increases once they get X number of certs under their belt, and they've got quite a good structure to try and continue to support people in their learning. You know, if you are a technology expert, one of the things you want to do is to keep learning your trade, and to be given that support to do that. I think that's an amazing thing. Otherwise, it's pretty much of a much, really. Most of the companies will offer some form of pension, some will offer sick pay, some will offer cycle to work schemes or health care. But I think because they're just sort of a package of benefits, they don't really necessarily do much for the individuals, and quite often they will just take it as a cash, they'll just take their benefits as cash payment rather than actual drawing on the benefits. So I think it's so personal to every individual that it would be very hard to put your finger on one thing that would be a major perk for people, other than supporting people in their training and creating a good work-life balance, because, ultimately that's, we go to work to live, not the other way around.
One thing on this, I would say, is how often are these salaries, put up for debate? Because I've heard from some personal friends that, a lot of these things are so debatable, so negotiable, that the advert doesn't really matter that much. I mean, they can even go up to 20% and things like that after you secure the job. So is that really the case, or?
I would probably say in very few cases I've seen companies that will offer that level of, of wiggle room within their salary grant. Because people, as individuals, you look at the person sat beside you who looks on the surface of it like they're doing the same job as you, would be pretty disappointed to think that they suddenly got offered X number of thousand pounds more than you just because they pushed a little bit. So there is less wiggle room than I think people would probably realise. I think if there was somebody who was so good at what they did and had the background to prove it, then yes, I think a company would go, well, we need to secure that person because otherwise we could lose this massive project. Yes, they're more likely to kind of be a bit more flexible in that. But if you are looking at, I don't mean this in a derogatory way, and I think it's really important to make this clear, but if you're looking at two comparable people where they're sort of standard consultant level, a client is going to not want to disgruntle their employees by offering somebody, another $6,000-$7,000 extra just because, that candidate pushed back a little bit. I think they're less likely to offer that. So I think that wiggle room is there only for the exception. It's not the rule.
The last question I was going to ask from my side is, because we've talked about, again, compensation, and we talked about, where these people are coming from. And you've alluded to something. It was like, okay, well, it may be a benefit for you to get a big salary. But as we are, as humans, you earn more, you spend more, you know, that's a given. I guess what I wanted to kind of understand, and I think Salesforce, they do have an opinion about this as well, and they do put some type of a number out there. But I was gonna ask to see what your experience is with this, about frequency of job changes, of people moving from one place to another. And to give you a bit of a kind of context to this, I've been following this this person on LinkedIn, and you know, they, again, they work kind of work in the sales community, and we've kind of engaged on a few projects in the past. And you know, she's been quite, I'm not exactly sure what the correct word is, to be honest, but you know, she basically moved a bit from, I think over the past 3 years, she's been with three companies. Okay. And right now she's in a very senior position and you know, kind of one of the companies that's some type of like senior consultant or product owner, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And basically, if you were to have looked at her skill set and compared it with someone else, they may have the same skill set. But the fact that she moved around every, I think probably like every 12 to 18 months, that type of thing, basically the next job was, in terms of seniority more than compensation, I'm not exactly sure about that, but in terms of seniority, she moved the level up or slightly up and so on. So if you think about it, you know, 3 years or 5 years, 5 years down the line, you know, she may be kind of, you know, some type of a more, you know, executive or so on and so forth kind of position in a consultancy or in an ISV partner, because she had that frequency of changing companies. So basically, my question towards that is, you know, is there like a range of a period where people should potentially look at changing jobs, or should it be kind of the classic of, well, you know, I will probably change jobs when I'm starting, when I'm stopping, or when I'm not learning anymore at my current job? What is your take on that?
I mean, funny enough, you've kind of got to look at this from two angles. So if we look at it from a client's point of view, they usually are investing a lot of money when they take somebody on, not just from like a perhaps recruitment cost, but it's from the cost of training and onboarding, the amount of time that they're investing into that person as well to develop their skills into that position. So companies are, you know, they're not going to be happy if candidates are moving on sort of after 12 months or something like that, because it's a huge investment from their point of view to get that person on board. So from a CV point of view, and the only reason I mentioned this is because it's important to see the world through the client's eyes as well, is that they're going to be looking for people that look on paper like they have some loyalty, because the thought of taking somebody on in a position and then losing them 12 months later to someone else means that they've got to backfill that position again. So that will be another cost to the business. So wrongly or rightly, they're probably going to be looking at CVs thinking, does this person look like they're going to be, you know, sticking around for a while, or do they look like they're going to be looking for their next career move in the next few months? However, having said that, if the candidate is showing a logical career progression, so they're not just sort of bouncing around aimlessly. So in that woman's instance, it clearly looks like she has a plan, she's ambitious. So every move that she makes is the next step up the ladder in her career. Then I think most companies will be able to see that. Where they're probably going to sort of pull up a red flag is where a candidate is maybe just jumping sort of sideways constantly. It might be then that the client will be looking at thinking, well, what was wrong with them in their last job that they're now moving into exactly the same position with no appearance of sort of stepping up to the next fresh challenge. When it comes to the individual, you kind of move when the time is right for you. It's reasonable to expect that at some point we might outgrow our roles. Some people actually like change quite frequently. So you know, I'm a coach, also sort of like do performance coaching and business coaching. And one of the sort of things you have is people have this, it's almost like an internal clock where every so often they need to change things in their life. And that could be they need to change their jobs, or they need to change house, or, you know, move home and stuff like that. So there could be something just quite natural within somebody that says, okay, I know now it's time for me to move on, because I've learned, I've taken as much as I can from this position, and now's the time for me to go and experience something new. So there's quite a few things to go to be going on to be able to just put a, or move every 18 months and you'll be fine kind of thing. Because some other people don't like change at all. And actually, those people, you'll look at their CV and they'll be in the same job for 16, 17, 20 years because they just don't like that change. And does that make them any better than anyone else? Well, possibly not, because they're not getting that more worldly experience than somebody who has bounced around a little bit more. So I think there isn't a definitive guide. As an individual, you need to know why it's right time for you, but also make sure that if you are the kind of person that is going to be back on the market again in 18 months' time, for example, that you're showing it's a logical career progression that you're making, and not just bouncing around just because you're wandering aimlessly and taking the next job where you can get it. Companies want to know, whilst you want to be valued as an individual, a company also wants you to, you know, to sort of value working for them as well. So I think if you can demonstrate on that on the CV, it shouldn't really be a problem.
That was our conversation. Certainly an interesting one for all of you, I hope. Definitely was for me. If you want to find out more about Teresa, you'll be able to find her on LinkedIn or via her Twitter handle at Teresa Durant, or contact her directly on her website, that's resourceondemand.com. I want to thank Teresa one more time for taking the time to join us and share some of her invaluable insight into the Salesforce recruitment world. So we hope you've enjoyed this conversation. Feel free to drop us an email at podcastguest@sfdzconsultant.com. Until next time, take care.